Welcome to another episode of My Weird Prompts, an AI-generated podcast featuring the random prompts of Daniel Rosehill as answered by a revolving cast of friendly AI characters. Join us for deep dives into AI, technology, and whatever other random thing Daniel finds fascinating today. Subscribe on Spotify or your favorite podcatcher. Now, today's episode.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Hi there, Herman and Corin. So we talked in the last episode about diplomatic protocol. You mentioned that motorcade planning was part of what the work of the protocol officers. We talked about advanced teams right before the G7 or G20 and how they kind of map out everything, really. You mentioned the height of the podiums, extreme detail. And planning as well for the transit of world leaders through motorcades. So I live in Jerusalem, as you know, and I wouldn't say we have a vast amount of motorcades in the sense that they're a significant nuisance in my daily life. And I have to say, this is a topic for another day. I've aired my grievances before about what I see as the complete lack of accountability in politics in Israel. And sometimes when I see a motorcade, I don't think too much about it other than, oh, that's just, I don't know, it's someone going. To be honest, when you live in a city like this, it stops becoming interesting after a while. You no longer really care or wonder who it is. And you kind of get sick of hearing the way they do it here. The police kind of use their loudspeakers and start barking for like 20 seconds before, I guess it's like before the motorcade. So it's a lot of noise. And sometimes the only thing it makes me think about these days is, what kind of disconnected leadership do we have in the world, in Israel here, but in generally where the only direct engagement citizens have with their leaders is through, sitting in traffic frustrated while a police officer kind of holds out his hands very determinedly saying, stop, you hear a bark noise and that's the leader gone. It kind of speaks to a vacuum of real engagement, I think. But that's the metaphorical side of motorcades. The practical side that I guess most people are probably wondered is, do they need that many cars? So when you have, you know, maybe Netanyahu, I think there's definitely different grades of motorcades I've observed. Sometimes you do see national flags on the front, so you can kind of infer it's a visiting ambassador or maybe sometimes a head of state, and you might see 10 cars. But sometimes you get the, especially when, you know, the U.S. president is in town, which happens a few times, it's colossal. We're talking like 30, 40 vehicles. The one that I always wondered about was the one with the little pointy things, which I gather is actually a jamming thing, which is very interesting. That's probably if there's one car I thought, oh, that's really interesting. It's that one. So that solved that mystery for me, but I still wonder, why 40 cars? It's colossal. Even if we talk about maybe, okay, there's a dummy car, there's an emergency medical thing traveling with him, there is a SWAT car, but that's three. So how do we get up there? Herman and Corin, I'd love to talk about the world of motorcades and what happens when things go wrong with them. I've actually read some cases in cities where these are not just, you know, here in Jerusalem, as I said, I think they're a feature of life, but it's not something that kind of has become a menace. But there's places in the world, I think like Washington, D.C., where motorcades are actually become a significant public nuisance. And because there's just so many of them, eventually things happen, like people get knocked down by a motorcade. And then the question becomes, which actually touches upon our last episode of legal liability in the complex world of diplomatic affairs, what happens if, you know, a motorcade, it's a car belonging to the U.S. government, and they knock over a local pedestrian. How does that local pedestrian get recourse? Is the driver of the convoy diplomatically immune? So Herman and Corin, let's talk. And finally, is there any move to make these things less annoying, like as in reduce the number of cars? Because, again, it just feels to me that the few times I see these things, beyond the volume and the noise, which if you live along the route of a motorcade is very significant, it just speaks to me to the massive disconnect between, let's say, the local population and the city I live in, Jerusalem, sections of the city get cut off for an event, the motorcade barges through, and you're kind of pushed to the side and feel, what is power? What is the system? If this is its pinnacle. It doesn't feel, something feels a bit wrong about it. Permanent corn, motorcades, and why so many cars in today's episodes of My Weird Prompts.
Have you ever been stuck at a traffic light in the middle of a Tuesday, just minding your own business, when suddenly the world seems to stop? The sirens start that low, rhythmic growl. The police motorcycles start swerving across lanes to block traffic. And then this endless line of black sport utility vehicles and armored sedans just sweeps past like a literal tide of power. It is an incredible sight. But if you are the person stuck behind the wheel three cars back, it is also incredibly frustrating. Especially here in Jerusalem, where the streets were already built for donkeys and carts 3,000 years ago, not for a 40-car motorcade.
Oh, I know that feeling well. Herman Poppleberry here, and I have to admit, even though I find the logistics of it absolutely fascinating, I still get that little twinge of annoyance when I am trying to get to the library and the entire city center is on lockdown. Our housemate Daniel was actually asking about this the other day. He has been watching these motorcades here in Jerusalem, especially with all the recent high-level diplomatic activity surrounding the new Peace Council meetings, and he noticed that some of them are just massive. We are talking 30 or 40 vehicles for a single head of state. He wanted to know why on earth they need that many cars, if there is any effort to make them less of a nuisance, and of course, the big legal question, what happens if one of those cars actually hits someone?
It is a great set of questions because it touches on everything from mechanical engineering to international law, and honestly, it follows perfectly from what we were discussing in a previous episode about diplomatic protocol and advanced teams. If you remember, we talked about how much work goes into the choreography of a visit before the leader even steps off the plane. The motorcade is really the physical manifestation of that choreography. It is not just a line of cars. It is a mobile fortress. And the technology inside that fortress has reached a level that feels more like science fiction than automotive design.
That is exactly the right way to think about it, Korn. A mobile fortress. When people see 40 cars, they think it is just for show or ego, but every single one of those vehicles has a very specific, often life-saving function. Let us break down what is actually in that line. At the very front, you usually have the route cars and the pilot car. These are often local police or security who are essentially clearing the way and looking for any last-minute obstacles. They are the ones you see aggressively blocking intersections and barking orders over loudspeakers.
Right. And then you get to the heart of the beast, or, in the case of the United States president, the literal beast. I understand there have been some major upgrades to the presidential fleet recently.
Oh, absolutely. The latest model of the presidential state car, still colloquially known as the Beast, is a marvel. It is not just armored, it is a sealed ecosystem. We are talking about 8-inch thick armor plating made of a combination of steel, aluminum, titanium, and ceramic. The windows are 5 inches thick and multi-layered, but the real recent upgrades are in the tech. It now features biometric access fingerprint and retina scanners to ensure that only authorized agents can even open the doors or access the secure communication panels. It is also rumored to have an advanced night vision system projected onto the windshield and a completely independent oxygen supply that can withstand a sustained chemical or biological attack for hours.
And it is heavy, right? I remember you mentioning the weight before.
It is massive. It weighs somewhere between 15,000 and 20,000 pounds. That is as much as a medium-duty commercial truck. Because of that weight, it requires a heavy-duty truck chassis and specially designed run-flat tires reinforced with Kevlar. Even if the tires are shredded by gunfire or an explosion, the car can keep moving at highway speeds on its steel rims. And in the trunk, they keep a refrigerated supply of the president's specific blood type and a full emergency medical suite. It is basically a rolling emergency room.
But Daniel noticed that there is never just one of these. He saw two identical ones the other day.
That is the shell game, Korn. They usually travel with at least two identical limousines, sometimes three. They have identical license plates and flags. This is a classic security tactic called redundancy and deception. If an attacker is looking for a target, they have no way of knowing which vehicle the principal is actually in. They call them stagecoach and spare. If the primary car breaks down or is hit, the president is immediately moved to the spare. It halves the chances of a successful first strike.
So that is two or three cars. What about the other 37? Daniel mentioned seeing some new, very aggressive-looking SUVs in the mix recently.
Good eye, Daniel. The Secret Service has recently started integrating heavily armored Cadillac Escalades into the motorcade, supplementing the traditional Chevrolet Suburbans. Behind the limos, you have the follow cars, often nicknamed halfback. This is where the elite protection detail sits. If you look closely, you will sometimes see the rear window or the side door slightly ajar. That is so the agents can return fire or bail out instantly without fumbling with door handles.
And then there is the car with the pointy things. That is the one that always fascinates people.
That is the watchtower, or the electronic countermeasures vehicle. Those pointy things are a forest of antennas and sensors. Their job is to create an electronic bubble around the motorcade. They are constantly scanning for and jamming radio frequencies that could be used to trigger remote-controlled, improvised explosive devices. These systems have to be increasingly sophisticated because they are also looking for drone signatures. They can essentially fry the electronics of an incoming suicide drone before it gets within 100 yards of the convoy. It is electronic warfare on a city street.
I imagine that bubble messes with everyone's cell phone reception as the motorcade passes by.
It absolutely does. If you are standing on the sidewalk and your call suddenly drops or your navigation starts spinning, there is a good chance a high-level motorcade just went past. It is a temporary dead zone.
We also have the heavy hitters, right? The guys who don't look like they are wearing suits.
Exactly. That is the counter-assault team, or CAT. They travel in a specialized SUV with a rear window that pops open. These are the guys with the heavy weaponry assault rifles, flashbangs, and sometimes even mounted machine guns. Their job is not to protect the leader directly. It is to provide a massive base of fire to suppress an ambush so the limos can escape. They are the hammer.
And we can't forget the Roadrunner. That sounds like a cartoon, but it is actually quite serious.
The Roadrunner is the mobile command and control vehicle. It is the one with the large satellite dish on top. It provides encrypted voice, data, and video communications. It ensures the leader is never out of the loop, even for a second. Whether it is a nuclear launch authorization or a high-stakes negotiation for the Peace Council, the leader has the same connectivity in the back of the limo as they do in the Situation Room.
Then you have the support vehicles, the ambulance, the hazardous materials mitigation unit, the staff vans, and the press corps. When you add it all up, you easily hit 40 vehicles. But Herman, let's talk about the cost. I saw a report recently that moving the United States president costs something like $2,614 per minute. Is that accurate?
It is. Roughly $156,000 per hour for a standard trip. When you consider that the White House transportation budget is around $350 million a year, you realize that this is one of the most expensive logistical operations on the planet. Every time they move, they have to fly these vehicles ahead of time in massive C-17 Globemaster cargo planes. It is a logistical symphony that happens days before the actual visit.
Which brings us back to Daniel's point about the nuisance. If it costs that much and causes that much disruption, why not scale it back? You mentioned the Dutch Prime Minister biking to work. Why can't more leaders do that?
It comes down to the threat profile and the philosophy of security. In some cultures, like the Netherlands or Scandinavia, there is a high value placed on the leader being accessible and one of the people. They use security through integration. But for a United States president or a leader in a volatile region like the Middle East, the Secret Service doctrine is built on the impenetrable perimeter. They don't want to integrate, they want to dominate the environment. They see every car they remove as a hole in the armor.
It feels like an arms race. As the threats get more sophisticated, drones, long-range sensors, cyber attacks, the security detail responds by adding more layers, more jamming, more decoys. But it creates this massive optics problem. If you are a leader, and you are separated from your people by 40 armored vehicles and a wall of sirens, it is hard to claim you are in touch with their daily struggles.
There is a term for this in diplomatic circles, the bubble. Once you are inside that motorcade, the world outside becomes a silent movie playing on the other side of 5 inches of bulletproof glass. You don't hear the sirens, you don't hear the people shouting, and you certainly don't feel the potholes. It is a very sterile, very isolated environment.
Let's get into the darker side of this, though. What happens when the bubble breaks something? Daniel asked about the legal liability if a motorcade hits a pedestrian. This isn't just a hypothetical. There have been several high-profile incidents where diplomatic or official motorcades have caused accidents. Who is responsible? Is the driver immune?
This is where we get into the weeds of the Vienna Convention on Diplomatic Relations, signed in 1961. It is the foundation of modern diplomacy. Under the convention, diplomatic agents enjoy immunity from the criminal jurisdiction of the receiving state. They also enjoy immunity from its civil and administrative jurisdiction, with a few exceptions.
So if a diplomat is driving the car, they can't be sued or prosecuted. That sounds like a get-out-of-jail-free card for reckless driving.
Generally, that is the starting point. But we have to distinguish between the principal and the staff. Most motorcade drivers are either local security forces or members of the leader's own security detail. If the driver is a member of the diplomatic staff, they usually have what is called functional immunity. This means they are immune from prosecution for acts committed as part of their official duties. Driving a motorcade is definitely an official duty.
That sounds incredibly unfair to a victim. If I am crossing the street and a motorcade driver is speeding or being reckless and hits me, I just have no recourse because of a treaty from 1961.
It isn't quite that simple. While the individual might be immune from personal prosecution, the state they represent is still responsible. Most countries have insurance for their diplomatic fleets. For example, the United States State Department has a process for handling administrative claims for property damage or personal injury caused by their vehicles abroad. They usually try to settle these claims to avoid a diplomatic incident. The goal is to make the victim whole without dragging a diplomat into a local court where they might be harassed for political reasons.
But what if they don't? What if a country just says, "We have immunity, we aren't paying"?
That is when it becomes a state-to-state issue. The victim's government would have to take up the case with the foreign ministry of the driver's country. It can get very ugly. There was a famous case in 1997 where a diplomat from the Republic of Georgia, Gorgoy Makaradze, was driving drunk in Washington, District of Columbia, and killed a 16-year-old girl. He had full diplomatic immunity.
I remember that. There was a huge public outcry. Did he get away with it?
No. In that case, because the crime was so egregious and the public pressure was so high, the government of Georgia actually waived his immunity. That is a crucial point. Immunity belongs to the state, not the individual. If the home country decides that the behavior was so bad that it is damaging their international reputation, they can waive the immunity and allow the person to be prosecuted in the host country. Makaradze was eventually sentenced to 7 to 21 years in prison.
But that is a criminal case involving a drunk driver. What about a motorcade accident where it is just a consequence of the aggressive driving style they use? You know how they drive, Herman. They don't stop for anything. They are trained to keep the wheels moving no matter what, because a stationary target is a dead target.
Exactly. That is the tactical doctrine. If a motorcade hits a pedestrian, the cars behind are often instructed not to stop. They have to keep the principal moving. It looks heartless, but from a security perspective, an accident could be a setup for an ambush. So the lead car might hit someone, and the entire motorcade just keeps going while a trailing local police car is left to deal with the aftermath. This creates a massive gray area. If a local police officer on a motorcycle hits a pedestrian while clearing the path for a foreign leader, that officer doesn't have diplomatic immunity. They are subject to their own country's laws. But often, the government will try to shield them because they were acting on orders to protect a high-value guest.
It feels like the rights of the individual citizen are sacrificed for the perceived safety of the leader. Is there any move to update these laws? I mean, the world has changed a lot since 1961.
There are constant debates about it. Some legal scholars argue for a mandatory insurance pool that all diplomatic missions must contribute to, which would pay out claims regardless of immunity. The idea is to separate the protection of the person from the financial compensation of the victim. You can keep the diplomat out of jail to prevent political harassment, but you still make sure the victim's hospital bills are paid. We saw a lot of this conversation resurface after the Harry Dunn case in 2019, where a diplomat's wife left the United Kingdom after a fatal accident. it brought the whole issue of immunity into the public consciousness in a way we haven't seen in a long time.
So, for Daniel and everyone else stuck at those intersections, what is the takeaway? Are we just stuck with these massive convoys forever?
For the foreseeable future, yes. As long as the threat environment remains high, the motorcades will remain long. But I think we might see more technological shifts, maybe fewer cars, but more advanced aerial surveillance. Or perhaps a shift toward more helicopter travel for the principal, which would reduce the street-level impact, though helicopters have their own noise and security issues. We saw this recently at the Davos summit, where some leaders were moved by Marine One helicopters to avoid the mountain roads entirely.
I have noticed that in some cities, the motorcade is just a decoy while the leader is actually moved by air. But that is expensive and requires a lot of landing zones. It is all about trade-offs. There is no perfect solution that provides 100% security and 0% public nuisance.
Exactly. The motorcade is the compromise we have settled on, for better or worse. It is a mobile command center, a hospital, a fortress, and a very complex legal entity all rolled into one.
Well, it certainly gives you something to think about the next time you hear those sirens. It is a fascinating tension between the absolute necessity of protecting world leaders to maintain global stability and the very real impact on the lives and rights of the citizens they are supposed to be leading.
And a very loud one at that. I think we should probably wrap this up before I start getting into the technical specifications of the tire pressure systems on the follow cars. I can see your eyes starting to glaze over, Korn.
Just a little bit, Herman. But hey, I appreciate the deep dive. It really puts Daniel's observation into a much broader context. It is one of those things that seems simple on the surface, but is actually incredibly deep once you start pulling at the threads.
That is what we do here. If you enjoyed this dive into the world of motorcades and diplomatic immunity, we would love it if you could leave us a review on your favorite podcast app. It really helps other curious people find the show.
Absolutely. And remember, you can find all our past episodes, including the ones we mentioned today, on Spotify and at our website, myweirdprompts.com. We have an RSS feed there if you want to subscribe directly, and a contact form if you have your own weird prompts you want us to explore.
Thanks to Daniel for sending this one in. It was a great excuse to dig into some of my favorite technical and legal rabbit holes.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks for listening, and we will talk to you next time.
Until next time, stay curious.
So, Herman, be honest. If you were in a motorcade, which car would you want to be in? The one with the pointy antennas or the one with the counter-assault team?
Oh, the pointy antenna car, without a doubt. I want to see the signal spectrum in real time. I want to see the bubble.
I knew you were going to say that. I think I would take the ambulance. At least it has the best snacks, probably.
I don't think that is how that works, Korn.
A guy can dream, Herman. A guy can dream. All right, let's get out of here before the police block the exit.
Good call. See ya.
See ya.
This episode was generated using Gemini Flash 3. Text-to-speech engine was Chatterbox Turbo.
Thanks for listening to another episode of My Weird Prompts, an AI-generated podcast featuring Daniel Rosehill's AI prompts, as answered by a revolving cast of friendly AI characters including me, Cornelius the Sloth. Subscribe on Spotify or visit myweirdprompts.com.